You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I go out of my way to do my best to bring you conversations with technologists who have spent time on call. And I say that jokingly because I really do go out of my way to get one every week. So far, I've only missed one week, and must say that it's been difficult sometimes to find people, so I really do need your help. And if you'd like to take part in the podcast, it's pretty easy to do. First of all, you can send me an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or you can reach out on Twitter. It's @oncallnightmare on Twitter, or @jdestro for me personally. So this week I am back here in New York City. You kind of can hear Rico grumbling in the background. Let's see. Okay. Of course, this time I make some quiet time for him to make some sounds. He goes quiet on me. Thanks, Rico. Thanks for the embarrassment. Anyway, that's my dog, Rico. Anyhow, I'm home this week after a week last in Seattle for Microsoft Build and Bits of Build, which were two events that I took part in. Coming up this week, I'll be at ChefConf for a little bit. I'll also be at DevOps Days Toronto coming up. And then I'm also making plans to be at DevOps Days Portland and DevOps Days in Chicago. I've purchased a digital recorder, which I'd like to use for in-person interviews. So if you'd like to be part, make sure you let me know you're going to be one of those events. We'll find a quiet spot, and then we'll do one of these interviews. I think it'd be really fun. So getting on to this week's interview. This week I speak to a buddy of mine that I met, I guess, just because of the DevOps community. I think that one of the most important parts about being involved in the DevOps community is the people that it's really connected me to. They are tremendously important to my career and my life now. They bring me a lot of joy in hearing what they're up to and finding out about their stories. And Rich is one of those people. So let's take a listen to this interview I did with Rich Burrows. He's of Gremlin, which is a chaos engineering as a service company. And I think if you're building for resiliency, it's something you should take a look at. So let's take a listen to this interview with Rich, and then we'll close up the podcast this week. All right. Thanks. And you're listening once again to the On Call Nightmares podcast. And every week I bring you conversations with technologists who have spent time on call. So, you know, last time I spoke with someone from Gremlin, I felt it was a enlightening conversation with one of their founders. And while I couldn't bring you another founder again, I brought you someone I think is pretty damn cool. Rich Burrows is a community manager at Gremlin, and he's focused on growing and strengthening their chaos engineering community. Yeah, because I, let's face it, folks, I get tongue-tied. I'm from Staten Island. Before he worked at Gremlin, he worked over at Puppet as an SRE and in other operational roles over the years. What did you say, about 20-something years as a person in on-call? Is that right, Rich?
Yeah, on and off. I mean, I think the whole total of the time that I was in rotations is probably about 20 years.
Yeah, I can say that I was probably on-call consecutively between jobs, maybe for like 10 years.
Yeah.
But within a 20-year or so career, I'd say, you know, I was on-call maybe 50 to 60% of it, maybe 65%.
Yeah.
So it's all about, I guess, what you end up moving into later in your
career. Totally. I mean, my first job, I was a sysadmin at a small ISP in like 1996, right? And I got handed a pager, and I was on call for everything all the time.
So was that like your first foray into on call? Like, I didn't even get to ask that question. You gave it to me. So
yeah, we didn't really like, and back then, you know, it was my first job in the industry. And so I didn't even really know like how on call should work, or the fact that it was sort of insane that I was like on call all the time.
Well, you know, what's funny is it 1996, I don't know if anybody really knew how on call worked. And that's the funny part about how a lot of us who got our starts I would say between like 96 to 2006, we got the full brunt of how to do it wrong, because that was a big period of fast growth, then plummeted, just complete plummeting of the industry, and then another period of just tremendously rapid growth. So it's crazy to have been, you know, I can say, you know, you've been part of that. You've seen the change in the culture around On Call as long as I have. So tell me, after you were at that small ISP, the pager all the time, what happened after that? Where did you go that maybe you were on call?
Yeah. So my next gig after that was I worked at WebMD. So I was the guy who used to deploy the webmd.com site, which at that point in time, this is like late 90s, you know, it was, they were taking out Super Bowl ads, you know, it was super high traffic and very, very visible. And then,
so is this like Java stuff? Like,
yeah, it was. In fact, we had our own Java web server. We had a custom web server that was written in Java.
Yeah, I had to imagine back then a lot of that stuff is Java. So what year are you talking about? 99, 2000?
Yeah, it was like 98 to 2000 when the bubble burst. On the front end of the bubble bursting. And so they ended up closing our office. And then I worked at a small web hosting company after that. I wasn't really on call much there. And then I went to this company that that I was at for about 10 years. So it was, again, a Java shop. We did financial transactions, so like gift and loyalty cards. So we had point of sale devices out in the field that were sending, you know, transactions into our front end. And I was there for about 5 years, and then we got acquired, and then I stuck around for like another five. And then I had like one job in between there and Puppet, I think.
And so were those, just to talk about that one job where you were supporting these like point of sale. Now this is probably pre like Wi-Fi devices, right? Like, are these like point of sale using some sort of like local LANs, or were you part of supporting that as well?
I didn't have a lot to do with the actual point of sale end, but there were some physical point of sale devices that that people bought, but there also were some goofy things, like there were some boxes that ran like Windows XP that had like point of sale applications on them, and so it was I think a pretty big range of things. And I think some of the devices probably were wireless though, even at that point.
Oh, okay, I got you. Cool. So let's move a little bit forward. You go to Puppet.
Yeah.
And there you're an SRE, and there you're seeing, what year is this? Maybe, would you say?
So I was there for about a year and a half, and I left there about a year ago.
Okay. So around 14, you'd say 14, 15, around that. And Puppet, you're seeing production systems related to people using Puppet.
So the Puppet SRE team, at least in the point of time that I was there, was interesting in that the company wasn't a SaaS, right? Their main product was the software that you install on prem. And so while we did have some properties that were in the cloud that we worried about, like they have this thing called Puppet Forge, which is how people share Puppet modules with each other. And the team that I was on, we were the ones who were responsible for operating that and for its availability. But a lot of our focus...
Like remote managed services for these people in a way?
No, not really. The big thing that we've actually focused on as a team was our internal CI pipeline. Because we were shipping on-prem software, you know, CI was like one of the most important things, you know, that we did as an engineering org. And so that was really the big focus of the team that I was on. The other thing that we did is we dog fooded Puppet Enterprise, the commercial product. And so we ran an installation of it internally that we used to manage our own infrastructure and gave feedback to product management and engineering and things like that.
Gotcha. So you were spending a lot of time just mostly keeping what Puppet is going as a software shop. It's just building the new versions, testing the new versions, getting those releases out,
probably working with release engineers or something of that nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I had Paul Reed on the show a few weeks back, and he talked a lot about release engineering and their role in this like delivery process. And it's pretty amazing to hear some of the work that goes into that, and you know, how it goes all the way down to the SREs and eventually maintaining all the services that eventually are being deployed.
We had a really talented release engineering team there. And I think that they were like 60% women, something like that, which was pretty rad too.
Nice. That's really cool to hear. So we go forward to Puppet, you jump around Sensu for a little bit, and you start making kind of a transition in your career. And now you're over at Gremlin, just kind of helping people learn about chaos engineering. But before we talk about that stuff, it's interesting how, you know, people in this industry, we have people who you kind of, you meet and you have, I guess, a great rapport with because you have similar career paths. And, you know, when I get to talk to you, it's been really great to be able to get to know you, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I'm really glad we get to have this conversation. I don't always just have on friends. I have a lot of strangers on this show.
Yeah.
But it's really cool to be able to have someone on that, you know, I've met because of this business and a lot of it around, you know, people who have tried building things and talking about what they've built and going out in the world. And, you know, I feel that you've got a great story and why I wanted people to kind of hear from you. So thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I know this, the intro was long, but I wanted to be able to kind of lead into something that was more than just, you know, a bio. I just wanted to say, thank you for being part of this.
Yeah, honestly, part of the reason why I made this transition and got out of operations was the fact that I had been on call for so long. And I really do think it had some negative impacts on me. And I was thinking about it, and it was like, I don't want to be 65 years old and have pager duty waking me up, right? Like there's, at some point I've got to move on to something else. And at first I thought that was going to be product management, but I feel like community management is even a better fit for me.
Well, that's great. And you know, the thing is that for some people, there's no problem with being 65 and on call. I think it's simply a decision that people make about where they feel like their lifestyle, their career is. Some people thrive on call, and that's why we keep the podcast going, because I've got a lot of people who have reached out to me who told me, you know, I'm on call. I get a lot of these stories. So,
There definitely are positive things about it. You know, I mean, I tend to, when I talk about being on call, I tend to talk about the negatives a lot more, but the reality is that it can be really fun sometimes, and dealing with weird incidents and things. There's like this kind of team bonding that happens when you're all kind of going through the fire together, and that can be really fun at times.
I think that there is an emotional amount of labor that is spent, and, you know, in the last conversation I had, you know, this is work and it does cause trauma. You know, the last conversation I had with Mike Julian, you know, he reminded me to make sure that I take this seriously, that when I say, you know, there are situations that can be, you know, traumatic to people that can really impact you because of the time. Mm-hmm. And I respect that more and more after I talk to people week to week with these stories. And I want to get into yours in just a second, but I think one of the things that I've really got from all these stories is that everybody in the end wants to just help someone get a little bit better, whether it's the application that they're running, their service, a website, even the people that they work alongside. And so I think that's why it's fun to do this podcast, because it's great to collect these stories and listen to how people want to get better.
Yeah, I think that I really like the point of view, and I don't think I came across this before I got sort of involved in the DevOps Days community, but I feel like that idea that, you know, your sort of base assumption is that everybody that you work with is doing their best to do their job, right? And until you've seen some real specific evidence, you know, to the contrary, you know, assume that everybody has the best intent, and the, and, you know, like you said, learning is really important. If we're not learning, we're not growing, and we're going to get burnt out.
Yeah. I think the only things that don't have good intent are servers. Servers just react with what you put in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People for the, that you work with, for the most part, I think have best intent in what they do. It's what happens when you deploy what you build together. That's where you learn, I think, who put in the most time thinking about other people's time.
And when yeah. I say,
like, who created tests that checked for certain things? Who did security, you know, pen tests against the software to ensure that there wouldn't be any sort of cross-site scripting that occurs?
Yep.
And then who assured, you know, the database calls that occurred, you know, were going to be cached at a certain level so it didn't overload, you know, our big database?
Yep.
And I think that that's the real interesting part of how modern operations has changed things.
Whereas, well, and I mean, even, you know, if folks do have the best of intentions, they're still operating under constraints, right? We've all, nobody has an unlimited amount of time or, you know, unlimited staffing. And so, you know, we're always making priority decisions about, you know, what we should be working on and improving. And nobody gets to do exactly what they want.
And I think in like the DevOps world now that we have, it's much easier to avoid those situations where code gets written, thrown over the wall, and then someone deploys it. You find out afterwards all the bad stuff that happens. I think that, you know, that thinking about other people, and I guess what's, you know, software development and operators who use, you know, operational intelligence or emotional intelligence,
yeah,
and work with empathy, I think is what leads to those problems not being quite as big. But I think we've
Yeah, let me just say really quickly though, that mm-hmm. that's been a big shift in my career, like as a person. There's a point in time, and I think it's a kind of time period that we're going to be talking about, where I literally, I yelled at people sometimes in the office, right? I would get so upset about something that the engineers had done that I would be like yelling at people. And that's again, I think something really important that I've gotten out of the whole DevOps movement has been that focus on empathy. And I think that I've done a real 180 when it comes to some of those things. I can't imagine myself behaving like that now, you know, but part of it too is that I was under a lot of pressure and I was dealing with painful situations that other people's decisions had put me into. And that was my reaction sometimes, was to just kind of explode.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of us early on, and we don't realize it until someone says you just can't do that, or lashing out. Let's move on to a little bit portion of the podcast that I call the rules. So I'd like to hear a story from you being on call. But before you tell me that story, I just want to make sure that you know the rules. I tell them every single week. They are not that tough. So don't incriminate yourself because, you know, if you did something, I don't want you to get in trouble. And don't incriminate others because remember, we're always blameless when we do retrospectives. Yep. And help us learn, because that's what this podcast is. It's retrospective. So why don't you give me a story about a nasty kind of impact that happened, or I should say issue that happened. You know, maybe you had an outage from an on-call rotation. Give me what you got.
Yeah, so the best one I could think of is probably the most painful outage I've been through in my career. Now, to be honest, I can't promise that I was the person who was on call. This happened at that shop that I was at for a long time that did the, you know, the transactions from the point of sales. And I mean, this probably would have been in like maybe 2007, 2008. So I don't remember if I'm the person who actually caught the alert, but it was one of those incidents that was big enough where like everybody was pretty much involved. Like our whole operations team and a good chunk of the engineering team were all like actively dealing with this issue for days. So what happened is we had active data centers, right? So we had two data centers. We're taking traffic from these point of sale devices. They are routing to one of the two two data centers based on DNS entries, right? Each customer has their own DNS URL that they hit, and they're generally pointed at one of the two data centers. And we ended up having a power outage in what we considered our backup data center. It was the one that we took less traffic at, but it was still taking about a third of the traffic that we did on a daily basis.
And your assumption is that the primary is up, you should be able to get through that. The assumption.
Right. Right. But it's scary, right? Because when you're only running on that primary, the next thought is, well, what happens if we have an outage on the primary, you know, then we're completely down. And so even being in that situation where we're running like in a kind of degraded mode, was super uncomfortable and something that we didn't want to have to sustain for any longer than was possible. So it was just a weird thing. We had a power outage. I can't remember the whole story, but the gist of it was that we thought that there should have been backup power and there wasn't. So there was a power event of some kind. It ended up frying our core switch there. And so we were just hard down in that data center. Like we couldn't do anything.
So now here's a question about that. And this goes into what remediations were after and what you learned from the situation is one, did it end up, going into a situation where you found out that it was your individual devices that needed some sort of power redundancy, or was it the actual data center that you were like using, leasing, own, whatever it was, didn't have the proper like redundancy? Which would you say it was?
It was the data center.
Okay.
And so, oddly enough, one of our, after this incident, we actually became very concerned about data center power. it was something that, you know, became very important to us after we went through this pain. But ironically, we actually had a power-related incident in our other data center just, I think, like 2 years later. And that was a data center that actually did have backup power that should have worked, but they had taken the backup power down for like 5 minutes to do some sort of data, some sort of maintenance. And during that 5 minute period, there was an event on the power grid and we ended up going down there too. So, but the first one was worse because we literally, you know, like I said, we fried our core switch. And so not only is everything down, but we don't have another piece of hardware that we can just stick in the rack, right?
Sure. Dead water.
Yep.
Just because you can't even, I mean, unless you like run down to the rack switch store and get yourself one, which what year would this be?
I would guess that this was probably about 2008, 2009, maybe. So yeah, it might have been earlier than that.
To get yourself a core switch, you know, you needed at least a lead of a, I don't know, one day. So
yeah.
I can see where it'd be kind of difficult because, you know, you're talking about a time where you couldn't just go on Amazon and say, yeah, you know what? I need this Cisco, blah, blah, blah. Get it shipped over to me in 15 minutes. You know,
the configuration was really complex too. So we actually were using Cisco switches and we had load balancer modules like on the switch. And so we were using the switch itself to do our load balancing. So the configuration for the device itself was kind of insane.
Were there backups for that? Or did you have to just work with Cisco to reconfigure everything?
I think our network engineer did actually have access to the config. This was one of the other sort of painful parts about the incident on a kind of personal level is that we had one network engineer and he was on his honeymoon in Hawaii when this happened. So he got to work through a bunch of his honeymoon. Because we had lost the switch. Now, I have to say, in the company's defense, they did try to make that right. They bought him another trip to Hawaii later on that they paid for completely. But yeah, it was pretty brutal.
Yeah, I think that we learn about how much on-call can be brutal for those of us when you don't make plans for when, like, that one person
is going out of town. And that's one of the things I've learned a lot about, I guess, better modern rotations, is that people seem to have better backup plans.
Yeah.
And really don't necessarily put one person in that position to be, you know, always getting the brunt of everything.
Yeah.
Because I've definitely been in a position where, you know, I had one boss. I was the only person that person employed. I worked for him. I did what he wanted. And it was at 4 a.m, a server wasn't responding. I had to take care of it. There was nobody else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, learning about that and how much that can take a toll on you taught me about how much better on call can really be. And it's good to see that it's actually become part of the DNA of a lot of companies.
Yeah.
Where they'll actually tell you, you know, everybody from this team is on call. This is how we do the rotation during like interviews. And I get a lot of, really impressed by that.
Yeah. I mean, and I will absolutely ask about that if I'm interviewing for an ops role. If they don't bring it up, that's definitely going to be one of the questions on my list.
Yeah. So let me ask you a little bit more. You've started this work for Gremlin now.
Yeah.
And you've learned about chaos, but what was the chaos that came out of that outage? I'm using puns.
No, it's actually, it's really funny because I mean, this is, you know, in chaos engineering, the frame of reference that a lot of people have is Chaos Monkey, right? Which is the thing that, Netflix built that would go in and randomly shut down their Amazon EC2 instances. Well, this was sort of a shutdown. It just happened to be the entire data center and it wasn't planned. So.
Sure. Yeah. What I was going to say, when faced with this kind of unplanned chaos, and if being on call, you know, what's something that you really would say to someone, you know, this is what I've learned from this incident. That's the best, one of the things. I know I was a roundabout way of asking.
Yeah.
You know, through all that chaos, what was learned?
So I think one of the biggest things that we learned was how we could deal with some of the issues that that had arisen through the applications that we had. So so this was sort of pre-microservices days, right? The company ended up like adopting a bunch of microservices later on. But at this point, we kind of had three monoliths. There was a monolith that took the front-end traffic. There was a monolith that that wrote down stuff in a database for reporting. And then there was another service that was like an auditing service, basically. And it kind of wrote down everything. So it would take all the Java objects and shove them into database. And what we actually ended up finding out, and we knew about this capability, but hadn't ever exercised it to this extent, is that using that audit database, we actually were able to replay previous transactions and send them out again on the message bus. And so, excuse me. So what we ended up doing is we had through all of this stuff that happened, you know, in that backup data center, the one that had the failure, we had lost some data. We had missed some messages in essence that should have been delivered, but just were never going to be delivered. And so one of our focuses was, you know, before we bring this thing back online, we've got to get that data into there, right? And it was too much data to just kind of ship over the wire back in those days. And so we ended up, you know, using this capability that was in our software, you know, to kind of replay all these messages. And I think the engineers did make some changes to it. They made it like multi-threaded and some things like that, you know, to kind of improve the performance of it. But it was something that that we didn't necessarily have a runbook for, right? Like we didn't have a plan for how to deal with this kind of outage and we ended up getting through it pretty well, I think. So besides the fact that like understanding the applications and how they work was important, I think the other big thing is that we were a group of people who I think worked pretty well together and we had that sort of team vibe, I think, you know, had each other's back. And, you know, we all pitched in and worked really hard, you know, for a few days until we got stuff under control. And that's a situation that I think would have been a lot worse in a shop where people maybe didn't, you know, like each other and didn't like working with each other and weren't, you know, willing to sort of like jump into the fire together.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Having a sense of camaraderie, especially when things are not really going well, is important. Yeah. It's not necessary, but it certainly helps. And that's
And we were, you know, looking out for each other and thinking about each other, like, you know, are people getting sleep? Are they eating? You know, all that kind of stuff. Those are things you have to think about, you know, when you're dealing with a major incident, you know? You know, this is probably, I think, the longest incident that I've been involved with in terms of the time span of it. I mean, I think that it was probably like at least like 4 days before we got that data center back online and taking traffic again. And we all were working pretty much, you know, around the clock in that time period.
Gotcha. So let's move along a little forward.
Yeah.
And let me ask you, if you were on call right now, what advice would you want someone to give you?
So, I think that probably the biggest one, honestly, is that you've got to take care of yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, I hopefully, you know, hopefully you're in a position where people are thinking about you and looking out for you. But one thing that I've learned in my career is that in the end, you know, you can't count on that. You can't count on anyone else to take care of you. You kind of have to be responsible for your own care. And so, you know, being able to do some self-care, being able to make sure that you use your PTO, that you're having some fun outside of, you know, being on call. I think that sort of stuff is really important.
Great. That's really important stuff. So here's some other question that I have. Tell me a little bit about chaos engineering. Tell me about a little bit what's going on at Gremlin and what you're doing.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a chaos engineering SaaS. So basically it's you know, you install an agent on your nodes or in your Kubernetes cluster, and it allows you to do a bunch of different kinds of chaos engineering experiments, like injecting, you know, latency on the network, or doing spiking the CPU on a given node, or adding memory pressure. There's all these kind of, you know, pre-baked types of chaos experiments that you can do, and it's honestly tooling that I wish I would have had, you know, when I was in these roles before, because the thing that I really like about it is that you are doing these experiments proactively, and the hope is that as you're doing them, you're finding problems with the way your distributed system works that you can correct and make it more resilient. But I think the part that appeals to me even more than that is the fact that it's a way to like learn about your system more, right? Like you're coming up with a hypothesis about how you think the system is going to behave, and then you check and see if that's really true. And I think that it gives you a way to get a deeper understanding of how the system is actually functioning, which, you know, when you're suddenly, you get that page at 3 a.m. and, you know, you get that call from PagerDuty or whatever, and you're, you know, you're sort of trying to clear your head and figure out what's going on, the better that you understand the system, you know, the better that you're going to be able to respond.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So tell me, what else have you got going on? Anything else you want our listeners to know before we kind of exit on to the end part of this interview?
Yeah. So I mean, I think the big thing is that we've actually started a podcast ourselves. So we have a podcast called Break Things on Purpose that's actually about chaos engineering. We just published our first episode. We've got our second one is coming out on May 21st. And it's me and one of my coworkers are the two co-hosts, and we're basically interviewing somebody every month about, you know, what they're doing with chaos engineering, what their practice is like, the things they've learned. We've done like 3 interviews so far, and it's super fun to get to talk to people. I'm sure you have the same experience, you know, to get to hear people's stories and the kinds of things that they're learning.
Yeah, storytelling is really what I love doing, and yeah. Hearing other people just tell me about their faults in their and their ability to rise up from faults is always super important. So that's why I'm doing my best to capture as many of them as possible. So
yeah, I think it's great, and you know, we're learning stuff too. You know, every time we talk to one of these people, we come away with, you know, something that we hadn't necessarily thought of before. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's called Break Things on Purpose. If people were on like, you know, Apple Podcasts and Google Play and Stitcher and sure, all of that, Spotify. So if you just search for the name, or we have a Twitter account too. It's just BTOP Pod. And that's a good place to get more information about it too.
Cool. I'll make sure that I put this in the episode notes so people know where to go. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening to myself and Rich mostly catch up and being buddies and talk about being old career nonsense, but for most of anything, for listening to us learn from one another. So Rich, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You got it. We'll be right back with the end of the podcast. Okay, we'll see you then. Thanks a lot, Rich. Well, that's this week's On Call Nightmares. Thanks a lot for listening. You know, it's been, months since I started this. I think I got started around December, and I'm really glad that I've been able to keep it going. And I would only keep it going if people were listening, and it seems like you are. So thanks very much. Keep up the emails and the tweets and anything you can to make sure that you're part of this project, because it's become really, really cool to be able to collect these stories. So we'll see you next week. I will be, like I said, in Seattle, so hopefully I can catch a cool interview while I'm there and give you another great episode of On Call Nightmares. So catch you next week.